Hello, my name's Dave Emery. Welcome to For the Record program number 312. This is being recorded on July 15th of the year 2001. Once again, we're going to be talking with Kevin Coogan, the brilliant author of the vitally important recent book Dreamer of the Day, subtitled Francis Parker Yockey and the Postwar Fascist International, published in softcover by Otano Media, copyright 1999. Kevin, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Thanks for having me.
Now, in Dreamer of the Day, your magnum opus, you use the career of Francis Parker Yockey, who was a Third Reich spy and a underground fascist activist throughout much of the mid-20th century, and you use his career and his set of associations as sort of a vehicle for illustrating what you call the post-war fascist international, although I might, I would perhaps supplement that by saying it really is the fascist international pre, during, and post-war. One of the major people that figures in your book and also in the career of Francis Parker Yockey, and someone who has wielded and continues to wield a profound influence in post-World War II fascism, is a guy named Willis Carto, and that last name is C-A-R-T-O. Kevin, if you had to synopsize Carto's career for someone that was not familiar with him, how would you characterize him?
Well, I think I would start with what he's best known for doing, and that primarily is as the founder and publisher of a journal called The Spotlight, which is actually based in Washington, D.C. The Spotlight is sometimes referred to as the New York Times of the far right. It has a large circulation and has been around since the 1960s. He also is the creator of a group called the Institute for Historical Review, which was set up first in California in the late 1970s, I think around 1978 or 1979. And this is probably the most aggressive single operation in the world that publishes and promotes Holocaust revisionism. Carto put this together, he funded it and he helped organize it. And he, for many, many years, ran it very directly. And then finally, in relation to my story, Carter is also the founder and of something called Noontide Press, which published the book Imperium that Yockey had written, and Carter has kept Imperium in print for about 40 years. One caveat to all this is that a few years ago, there was a very big battle inside the Institute for Historical Review, and it involved a legal case, and Carter actually lost control of both the Institute and the publication Noontide Press. But as a result, Carto is now trying to spin off his own operation. I think it's called the Barnes Review. But you can see that from the 1950s until today, Carto's had an extremely influential role inside the United States far right.
Now, some of his early publications, pre-Spotlight, were a couple of publications called Right and also the American Mercury. If you could touch on those for us.
Well, Right began in the mid-1950s. When Carto was based in California. In fact, Carto was actually based in San Francisco.
Now, excuse me for interrupting, Kevin, but this was before he hooked up with Yockey, correct?
Yes, exactly.
Right.
Yes, exactly.
Go ahead.
Carto came out of a far-right milieu that was very much pro-Senator Joseph McCarthy and very much isolationist, but by the mid-1950s had very much embraced the defense of segregationism. Because, remember, Brown versus Board of Education, I think, was in 1954, and the whole Southern segregation style was now starting to come under attack. So what Wright tried to do is that Wright tried to, through the publication of Wright, Carto tried to make connections with far-right groups all throughout the country, and particularly in the South. And the idea was that out of these connections, this would lead to a lobbying group inside Washington, D.C. for far-right concerns. And the publication of the magazine, The Spotlight, and the creation of the Liberty Lobby, which is really Carto's major organization, came out of really Right magazine.
And Carto hooked up with a lot of different organizations. I wonder if you could touch on the Virginia League and also the National States Rights Party. The latter one we'll come back to.
In the 50s, the Virginia League was one of the strongest groups organized around opposition to segregation, and they published a review that was widely circulated, really through the White Citizens Councils. The White Citizens Councils were a well-organized and actually rather well-funded group in the South that was sort of the upscale version of the KKK. Accardo had strong connections with the Citizens Councils, and he also had ties to the National States Rights Party, which was probably the most militant, really a terrorist organization that was involved in fighting integration.
And involved in a number of bombings throughout the 50s and 60s as well.
Yes, exactly. Also, not just against black organizations, but also against Jewish organizations, including a bombing against a synagogue in Atlanta. And this is actually kind of interesting because the given the times, the people were actually acquitted for that bombing because it was claimed that the FBI had somehow infiltrated their group. But the National States Rights Party had been involved in numerous bombings, all throughout the South.
One of the interesting things, not only about your book, but in studying the fascist landscape, so to speak, one comes across many groupings and political alignments that go against at least the more ideologized view of fascism. And for lack of a better term, one might call some of these relationships strange bedfellows. In some of our past talks, we've discussed African-American segregationists and white racists and segregationists and some of the practical alliances that they've formed. One of the many people who was involved with, at least as a practical ally, not an ideological ally, but a practical ally of some of the racist and segregationist elements associated with CARTO was none other than Marcus Garvey, head of the Universal Negro Improvement Association and someone that is revered to the Rastafarian movement. And I don't want to be misunderstood as characterizing Garvey as a racist or a fascist, yet we find political alliances between some of these elements. I wonder if you could flesh out the connections between Garvey and some of the allies of CARTO, for example, Ernest Sevier Cox, and how these seemingly diametrically opposed elements could have any sort of political alliance.
Well, I think the first point to make is that CARTO had absolutely no connection with Garvey himself.
Right.
Garvey had gone into, was really forced into exile in the United States, and actually I think wound up ultimately in England, where he died in the early 40s. But what did happen is that after Garvey's decline, there were different factions of the Garveyite movement. And one faction developed, I think it was called the Back to Ethiopia movement, which in the 40s was embraced by many people on the far right, because the movement was promoting this idea of voluntary repatriation of all blacks to Africa. So naturally, as segregationists, people like CARTO, you know, absolutely embraced this idea. Now, the really direct connection really to Garvey was not so much through CARTO, but the man you mentioned, Ernest Cox, who was at one point, Cox had been a member of the KKK, and Cox was very open about his racial views, he had become a friend of Garvey's, and Cox has even dedicated one of his pamphlets to Garvey. Cox continued in this idea of trying to promote an alliance between white segregationists and the people who wanted to go back to Africa. So there had been for years this kind of weird, as you say, strange bedfellow type relationship between these two elements. What CARTO did is that in the 1950s, he became aware of what Cox was up to, and he contacted Cox and began promoting Cox's ideas inside the pages of Right magazine. Now, this actually led CARTO through Cox into a really strange group called the Northern League for Pan-Nordic Friendship, which had been based in Scotland, but was really an organization that had chapters around the world. This group had been founded in India by a English settler named Roger Pearson. And in the 1950s, Pearson came to the United States spreading the word of the Northern League. And what he did is he made contact with a whole milieu of far-right extremists, including Gerald L.K. Smith and CARTO. And CARTO was so taken by the Northern League that CARTO founded a Northern League chapter in California called the Alpha Lodge of the Northern League. Now, other elements, for example, the Virginia League, the people who were behind the Virginia League, they turned themselves into the southern branch of the Northern League. So there was this underlying connection between all these groups, and actually looking at some of the FBI files, one of the FBI files states that there had been a sort of a secret relationship between the Northern League and the National States Rights Party, which is really interesting given that the NSRP at that time was involved in so many acts of terrorism.
One of the organizations that you mention as actually helping to provide money for Ernest Sevier Cox's abortive plan to try to relocate African Americans back to Africa was a fellow named Colonel Wycliffe Draper, who in turn was one of the main financiers for an organization called the Pioneer Fund. And this might represent something of a temporal or sort of it might be sort of anachronistic in that a lot of the depredations of the Pioneer Fund came after the time period we're focusing on. But many people may be familiar with the recent racist bestseller, The Bell Curve, that relied largely on the research of the Pioneer Fund. Could you tell us a little about the Pioneer Fund and Wycliffe Draper? Because that represents one element of this milieu that at the same time is ideologically opposed to the Northern League and some of the other people that we're going to discuss at greater length.
Well, the Pioneer Fund really stretches from the 1930s to today. In order to understand the Pioneer Fund, you have to understand that people like Wycliffe Draper, who was a wealthy textile industrialist, had been very much involved in the attempts to keep out, to reduce immigration, particularly immigration from Southern Europe. They did not want, as kind of classic WASP types, they didn't want, you know, Catholics, Jews, Italians, people from Poland, from Russia, etc., in the United States. And all throughout the 1920s, there was a very strong push to restrict immigration from Europe. And as a part of this, a kind of a racial anthropology developed to sort of show that people from certain parts of Europe had less intelligence than the Nordics, etc., etc. So the Pioneer Fund really began in the anti-immigration movement that sort of culminated in the 1920s in very restrictive laws against immigration to the United States. It then continued all the way through until the until today, financing studies on intelligence related to race and things like that. So the Pioneer Fund in the 1950s was very much fascinated and wanted to promote this idea of repatriation, and so the Pioneer Fund became a kind of a back channel funder to a lot of these groups. There was also a group called the International Association for the Advancement of I think it's Ethnology and Eugenics, the IIAEE, which was set up in the late 1950s, that was very much like the Pioneer Fund and also attracted many people from the far right. These were the kind of people who were not simply the sort of street core activists, but were, for lack of a better word, the sort of the intellectuals of kind of post-Nazi racial theory.
Now, the Northern League is an institution that also overlaps an institution we've covered before, namely the World Anti-Communist League and its core group, the APACL. That's something that younger people might be familiar with in connection with the Iran-Contra affair, because the American branch of the WACL was involved with that. Kevin, going back to the Northern League and Roger Pearson, Pearson hooked up with Willis Carto and the Liberty Lobby, and yet at the same time there are divisions between Pearson, at least ideological gaps between Pearson and Francis Parker Yockey, and Yockey also came to hook up with Carto. Could you describe the genesis of the Carto-Yockey relationship for us?
Well, first with Carto and Yockey, in the course of my book, I discovered, actually through an interview with Carto, Carto granted me one interview because Carto was himself sort of fascinated by Yockey and realized that I knew things about Yockey that he didn't, so he wanted to actually kind of hear from me as much as I wanted to hear from him. But in the course of the one interview that I had with Carto at the headquarters of the Liberty Lobby in D.C., he said that he first heard about Yockey through a far-rightist named Hamilton, who had been involved with Gerald L.K. Smith's Christian Crusade. Gerald L.K. Smith was a leading figure of the far right in the 1940s to really to the mid-1960s. Hamilton had met Yockey when Yockey came to hook up with the Christian Crusade after Yockey left England in, I think, 1951 or 52. And when Yockey came to hang out with Smith at Smith's headquarters in St. Louis, Missouri, he brought copies of Imperium with him of the original publication, which occurred in 1948 in London. Now, when Carto began organizing right a few years later, in 1955, Carto went on a tour, an extensive tour of the United States, trying to really network with other far rightists, and he met Hamilton, and Hamilton gave Carto a copy of the book Imperium. So the first time that Carto ever even heard of Yockey was really through the book Imperium, not directly. But then, incredibly, in 1960, Yockey had come to California and was arrested by the FBI on passport violation and wound up in a local San Francisco jail. Cardo, after hearing it on the news, was absolutely fascinated that the man that whose book he had read and who he admired was arrested, and so he actually went out and interviewed Yaki very briefly in jail, I think 3 or 4 days before Yaki died. And in my book, I actually reprint some of the notes that Cardo made from that interview. Now, from that period, Cardo began a policy to really try to promote Yaki's ideas, and he was involved in helping to organize the first printing of Yaki's book, Imperium, in the United States, which was printed through something called Truth Seeker Press, based in New York. And Truth Seeker Press is very much part of this milieu of sort of racist, genetic, theorists. And Truth Seeker Press was also, in fact, the head of Truth Seeker Press was a guy named Smith. And Smith had been a U.S. delegate to Northern League conferences in Europe. So from the very beginning of Cardo's encounter with Yaki, Cardo already had ties with the Northern League and this kind of pan-European network. As I had mentioned earlier, Cardo, in 58, I think, had met Pearson when Pearson made this tour of the United States. So there was a kind of convergence of Yaki's ideas that went back into the Northern League milieu through people like Cardo. But the basic division in the Northern League, and this is a pretty complicated division, but there's a division between people who are identified with a sort of German race theory, which holds the notion that Germanic blood and the contents of a person's blood type really literally determine their consciousness. And one element of the Northern League very much believed in that, and they had there's a man named Günther, who was a race theorist, kind of like a Volkisch race theorist, who was very popular in Nazi Germany in the 1930s, that people in the Northern League celebrated. However, there was another wing of the Northern League that was much more prone to what I call in my book a kind of an Italian view of fascism, because obviously, since Italians are not Nordic blondes, the people like Mussolini and his cohorts developed a notion of fascism that emphasized much more cultural issues rather than, biological or reductionism of sort of Nazi style. And inside the Northern League, the Yaki's ideas were more in a line with the people who were inclined to, quote, Italian version of fascism, because this emphasized much more the question of culture, history, and tradition, rather than simple, blood type.
A couple of other organizations, because I want to discuss the Nordic versus Waffen-SS, because a lot of people, and frankly, before reading your book, that would include yours truly, were not aware that there were significant ideological divisions within the SS proper. But in fact, that there were, and we'll develop that further, if not in this half hour, perhaps in a future discussion. But a couple of other organizations that overlap this milieu, and I want to stress for the purpose of the listeners that Dreamer of the Day, I think, could be accurately characterized as an encyclopedic work and talks about a lot of organizations that are not coterminous but that overlap and yet at times also fracture and become opposed, at least to a certain extent. A couple of organizations, the European Liberation Front, Kevin, something Yaki was very close to. Tell us about ELF.
The ELF had been organized in England in the late 1940s, and the ELF actually was a kind of a split movement out of the Union Movement, which had been controlled by Sir Oswald Mosley. Basically, the ELF represented the people like Yaki and a few of his cohorts who believed that because Mosley had been too pro-American in the Cold War period, that that fascism was becoming a kind of a front group for America, and that they rejected the argument that in the war between, say, the United States and the Soviet Union over control of Europe, the right should support the United States. They argued that the United States was actually a bigger threat to Europe than even Russia, which was a pretty unusual view inside the extreme right, and it caused a tremendous amount of controversy. So the ELF began as really a political propaganda group of Yaki and a group of friends that he'd recruited out from the Union Movement to promote this idea, and they formed an organization which had, I'd say, a few hundred supporters, and they also created a publication called Front Fighter where they could circulate their ideas. And this group really lasted from, say, 48 till finally it sort of faded out in 1954. But through that process, Yaki and his friends tried to basically spread the gospel that Yaki had outlined in Imperium around the through Europe and the United States. And when I mentioned that Yaki came to meet with and to work with the Christian Crusade, he really did so in an attempt to develop inside the Christian Crusade a group that he could split out away from Smith to form a kind of a co-group to the ELF in the United States. Now that failed, but what did succeed is that Yaki made contacts in New York with a guy named Fred Weiss. And Fred Weiss had been a funder of an organization called the National Renaissance Party. And the National Renaissance Party, really long before George Lincoln Rockwell's Nazi Party, was, I would say, the first sort of overtly pro-Nazi party in the post-war period. And through Weiss's connections to the NRP, a lot of Yaki's ideas were circulated, and some of Yaki's stuff was even republished through the NRP. So this long precedes what most people in the United States think of as the sort of the revival of Nazism with George Lincoln Rockwell in the late 1950s.
For the record, program number 270, and the last discussion that we had, Kevin, we talked about the NRP, and again, some of their view that elements as seemingly diverse and certainly opposed to fascism as Fidel Castro and the Soviet Union and even the People's Republic could be seen as useful counterweights to what they saw as the number one threat to world whatever excellence, perhaps, which was the United States.
Right, because they saw the United States as sort of being dominated by the Jews. So the United States is sort of part of this big Jewish conspiracy. And getting back to your discussion about Sevier Cox and segregation, the National Renaissance Party itself had actually pretty good contacts with black, for lack of a better word, black segregation elements inside New York. And there was even a group, I think it was called the Universal Church, which was a black segregationist group that the NRP regularly had held joint meetings with. In fact, they would even sit in segregated, aisles when they had their meetings. But the other point about this is that there was in New York a certain wing of black nationalism, which is probably a better word for it, the black nationalists who looked at the developments inside the Third World. For example, the fact that Egypt was involved in helping the Mau Mau revolt in Kenya against the British occupation. And so when they saw that the National Renaissance Party, for its own reasons, liked Egypt, you know, primarily because Egypt had allowed so many, Nazis Nasser allowed so many Nazis into Egypt, and people like Johann von Leers, who had been a major propagandist for Goebbels in the 1930s, was actually put in charge of running a lot of Egyptian propaganda against Israel. The black nationalist elements saw that they themselves could kind of make their own deal with the devil by working with the NRP.
A couple of other organizations that overlap this milieu, and again, I want to stress for listeners that a lot of these groups overlap, and yet there are people within these groups who hate each other.
Absolutely.
A couple of organizations, Kevin, we have maybe another 3 or 4 minutes before we have to move on to another side, but the Defenders of the American Constitution, an American-based organization, and the League of Empire Loyalists. I wonder if you could tell us about those two organizations and their respective founders, General Pedro del Valle and Keith Chesterton.
Well, the Defenders of the American Constitution was a far-right group of retired military officers headed by General Pedro del Valle, who had been a Marine Corps general who I believe was involved in the battle for Okinawa. Now, one of the things you have to understand about the United States military is the United States military had many, many people at high levels from, who were segregationists, people who came from the South. I think Del Valle himself may have come from Texas. And they became involved in, they had right-wing politics. So when they left the military, they began trying to set up an organization called the Defenders of the American Constitution, which was lobbying against what they saw was the Eastern liberal establishment that was encouraging desegregation and was not, fighting the commies and not willing to go to war against the commies, et cetera, et cetera. So they began looking around for friends, and one of their friendly organizations in England was the League of Empire Loyalists, which was headed by a man named Chesterton. And Chesterton believed that the one-worldist Jewish conspiracy was behind England losing all its colonies, and that groups like NATO were really, you know, it was a wicked organization and things like that. And so you had this kind of weird combination of they were on the one hand anti-communist, but they were also extremely isolationist. And in the case of the League of Empire loyalists, very much committed to the maintenance of the British Empire. So they formed alliances between each other. And you can look at the publication of the Defenders of the American Constitution. You can see discussions of their meetings with people from the League of Empire Loyalists.
I would note, too, that Del Valle was part of the MacArthur Group. And
yes.
One of the things that's interesting is to see, on the one hand, people like Yaqui, who advocate alliances or at least affinities with elements as disparate as Castro and the former Soviet Union in order to prevent American domination, occupying part of the same political landscape as people like Del Valle and others of the MacArthur Group, who were nothing if not virulently anti-communist.
Precisely. I mean, in a certain sense, that's why my book got so big, because there are so many complicated cross streams and cross currents going on within all these organizations, and to try and single out one by ignoring the others, you really miss an enormous amount.
Also, for the benefit of listeners, if this seems a little confusing, all of these names and all of these organizations, this is an accurate portrayal of the landscape, and the landscape itself is a very complex and uneven one, so that I think your book accurately reflects some of these divisions.
Well, the other thing you've got to understand is that not much has been written about this landscape, and so when I was first doing the book, there weren't that many reference points that even I could turn to, because a lot of this was really uncharted territory.
And you make liberal use of correspondence from some of these same individuals, revealing that they themselves had a lot of questions about some of their associates, and there are a lot of differences of opinion among organizations and individuals who would be generally classified as fascist, and yet there are strong divisions among those.
I mean, if you think of the experience of the far left and an SDS and all the fights that went on and all the internal divisions, this is very much this kind of pattern is not unique to the far right.
Yeah, and there are even some elements of the left, including some that we've already touched on, not necessarily the American left, but also the American left, that find common cause in certain areas with some of these fascist elements, anti-Americanism and, quote, anti-imperialism, unquote, being a couple of them.
Well, what Carter tried to do in the late 1960s, Carter tried to take advantage of the revolt against the war in Vietnam to develop what he called a, quote, populist coalition between the far left and the far right. And Cardo even organized what he called a war crimes tribunal to indict the Eastern establishment for war crimes in Vietnam, where he hoped to attract elements of the far left. There was another guy named Robert Miles, who was a leading member of the KKK in Michigan, and really later an architect of a lot of white nationalist movements in the Northwest. Miles himself had also set up a group that tried to recruit into not just the left, but also, again, into black nationalist elements as well.
Kevin, we'll take up this discussion in a future discussion, perhaps another half hour on the other side of this CD or tape. I'd like to give the particulars concerning Autonomy Media, because we're almost out of time. Autonomy Media can be contacted at P.O. Box 568, Williamsburg Station, that's Williamsburgh, one word, that's Brooklyn, New York, 11211-0568, USA. Phone and fax number, area code 718-963-2603. And you can visit their website at www.autonomedia.org. And I would add that the editing of the Dreamer of the Day was done by Dave Mandel, an on-air personality at sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey. I'd also like to give some of the particulars, Kevin, concerning Spitfire. Other interviews that I've done with Kevin Coogan, and there are a number of them, beginning with For the Record number 185. The most recent interview before this one was For the Record number 270. And all of those interviews are available from a tape duplication service called Spitfire. That's one word, Spitfire, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. And there's a list of and description of the various tapes available from Spitfire on the Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. Many of the interviews that I've done with Kevin Coogan and other broadcasts are streaming at wfmu.org/Dave Emery, one word, D-A-V-E-E-M-O-R-Y. And there's another longer URL that has the real that has the For the Record programs available on Real Audio for download, and there are links to both URLs on the Spitfire website. Kevin, we'll continue this discussion on the other side of this tape. For Kevin Coogan, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.